Hello, everyone. Welcome to this webinar, which focuses on continuing care services for drug court participants after their formal involvement with the drug court program has ended. My name is Carolyn Cooper, and I am the director of the Justice Programs Office at American University, a research professor at the School of Public Affairs at American University, and also director of the BJA Drug Court Technical Assistance Project. This webinar is one of a series of webinars that has been conducted by the National Center for State Courts and the School of Public Affairs at American University under the sponsorship of the Research to Practice Initiative, jointly funded by the U.S. Department of Justice's Bureau of Justice Assistance and the National Institute of Justice. We invite you to access the project website, researchtopractice.org, where the project's webinars are archived and other supporting resources can be accessed. For background, 5 additional webinars have been or are being prepared under this initiative. Targeting, that is identifying who the drug court program can best serve, the role of medication-assisted treatment as an adjunct to drug court services, principles of effective substance abuse treatment that are applicable to drug court programs, 7 evidence-based program design features identified during the multi-site drug court evaluation that are associated with effective drug courts, and shortly, performance measurements. For the purpose of this webinar, we are defining aftercare, continuing care, as the diversity of services to support recovery over the long term that are initiated during the period of active drug court participation and continue after the participant leaves the formal structure of the drug court program. Recognizing that substance addiction is a chronic relapsing disease that affects the brain and a wide range of cognitive functions and consequently multiple dimensions of an individual's life, the availability of aftercare services following the period in which the acute symptoms of the disease are treated through the drug court program is critical. We know from research on the treatment of other chronic diseases, diabetes, hypertension, asthma, for example, that the availability of aftercare services is critical to sustaining the effects of the treatment provided during the acute phases of the disease, and the treatment of substance addiction is no different. There are now over 2,500 various problem-solving court programs operating in the United States that focus on substance addiction, with hundreds of individuals graduating from these programs regularly. It is critical to ensure that sound aftercare services are in place to provide these individuals with the essential chronic care services that they need and that chronic disease research has shown are essential. And in addition, to ensure that the major investment that has been made during the period of formal drug court services is maximized in terms of long-term benefits after the individual completes the drug court program. The Bureau of Justice Assistance can provide resources to support drug court aftercare services, and we hope that you will follow up to determine what is available that might be useful. We also know that multiple modalities of aftercare services need to be available, just as with the treatment of the acute phases of substance addiction. One size does not fit all, and that continuing care aftercare services need to be initiated during the early stages of drug court program participation. As you will hear during this webinar, there is unfortunately relatively limited formal research on the effectiveness of aftercare services for persons suffering from substance addiction compared with the research available for other chronic diseases. But we will focus on 2 modalities which have some limited research findings. These, coupled with extensive anecdotal reports and support for the benefits of various other types of aftercare services, will, we hope, provide a framework for drug court programs to ensure that aftercare and continuing care service is a key element of their drug court program design. Citations to research referenced in this session are provided in the final slides. I would now like to introduce the presenters participating in this webinar. I am serving as facilitator. Our other 3 presenters, who bring a blend of research and practice perspective are Dr. James McKay of the University of Pennsylvania, Jeff Kushner, State Drug Court Coordinator at the Montana Supreme Court, and Judge John Schwartz, Drug Court Judge for the Rochester, New York Adult Drug Court, Mental Health Court, and Veterans Court. Jim, Jeff, and Judge Schwartz, please say a few words to introduce yourself.
Yes,
Dr. McKay?
Yes, hi. I'm a professor of psychology in the psychiatry department at the University of Pennsylvania, and my career has been focused on conducting research studies on continuing care for patients who have alcohol, cocaine, and other drug problems.
Good morning. My name's Jeff Kushner, and over the past 40 years, I've been the single state agency director for prevention and treatment in three states, Nebraska, Colorado, and Oregon. I've been the drug court administrator in St. Louis for the first 12 years of that program, and I've been the Montana statewide drug court coordinator for 5 years. I'm pleased to be here today.
I am John Schwartz, a drug court judge from Rochester, New York. We started the first drug court in Rochester in 1995, and now we have a mental health court, a veterans court, and a DWI court. We have over 1,000 participants in all of these courts. I'm also a founding member and former chair of the National Association of Drug Court Professionals and president emeritus of the New York State Association of Drug Court Professionals.
Thank you all. I would like to turn the session over now to Dr. McKay.
The reason why continuing care interventions are so important to people who have substance use problems is that these folks tend to have sustained vulnerabilities to relapse because of a number of problems that they have that either don't change at all, or if they do change, tend to change slowly over a long period of time. These include biological problems, could be genetic vulnerability to substance abuse problems, could also be problems in brain function, in judgment, and other factors like that. These, of course, are very slow to change. There are also behavioral problems that a lot of individuals with substance abuse problems have. These can include poor coping responses when they are stressed out and when they encounter high-risk situations. It can also include interpersonal problems, which can also be very slow to change. Next, a lot of people with substance abuse problems have very high-risk environments that they live in which they have very limited social support for recovery, and oftentimes being in neighborhoods where there's a lot of drug dealing, a lot of bars and other things like that. And finally, these folks often have co-occurring psychiatric problems like bipolar disorder or depression, which contribute to raising the risk for relapse. And again, these conditions can be treated, but they're often around for a long time and are relatively slow to change. So this means that we need interventions that provide support beyond the end of the initial more intense treatment, which is oftentimes quite short, and this is needed to deal with the problems that these patients are likely to encounter as they move forward.
Thank you, Jim. Jeff, could you clarify for us the distinction between acute care and chronic care regarding substance abuse treatment in a drug court setting, and also discuss briefly the concept of recovery and recovery support strategies? And then can you also discuss briefly how long aftercare and recovery support is generally needed for substance addiction?
Sure. Thanks, Caroline. Drug courts and treatment programs really should no longer utilize a model of acute care when it comes to alcohol and other drug abuse treatment. The acute care model is characterized by crisis-linked timing, a focus on immediate abstinence where professionally dominated decision-making processes are the norm, with relatively short treatment-service relationships, where drug use, instead of being seen as a symptom of the disease, often results in termination from treatment or from drug court, and an expectation of full and permanent problem resolution by the time graduation occurs. we need to carefully think about methods to support ongoing involvement of our participants in recovery activities and to facilitate reentry back into treatment when it's necessary, during and after discharge from drug court. This will prevent and cut short relapse, which in turn will reduce reoffense rates and promote a long-term recovery for individuals and families affected by severe substance use disorders. We all know that alcohol and other drug dependence is a brain disease. It takes years to develop, and in many cases, years to overcome. Establishing long-term recovery may take multiple treatment episodes, continued support after treatment, and after drug court. Additionally, research indicates that long-term outcomes are better with family support as well. And we in the drug court field need to do a better job, particularly with adult drug courts, in working with families for improved long-term outcomes. In an effort to develop a framework for this discussion, hopefully this slide will help. This is the definition for recovery developed through SAMHSA's Recovery Support Strategic Initiative. Recovery is a process of change through which individuals improve their health and wellness, live a self-directed life, and strive to reach their full potential. The definition includes four dimensions that support a life in recovery. First, good health, including abstaining from alcohol, illicit drugs, and non-prescribed medications. Second, having a stable and safe home. Third, having a life with purpose, meaning that a person has a job, maybe going to school, positive family relationships, being independent, and that includes, of course, being crime-free. And fourth, having a relationship with the broader community, what William White calls really being a good citizen. Drug courts can be a critical part of long-term recovery for many who have reached a crisis through interface with the criminal justice system. While the pathway to recovery may involve periods when activities are directed to a large degree by others, like the initial phases of drug court, recovery eventually has to be fundamentally a self-directed process. The person in recovery ultimately must exercise choices and make decisions based on their recovery pathway and goals. We need to understand that while we initially direct the activities of our drug court participants, the drug court team has a responsibility to help the individual participant move to what CSAT calls, again, taking charge and exercising choices and decisions regarding their own recovery. This transition is critical if we expect there to be long-term recovery. Improving cost effectiveness, reducing reoffense rates depends on the drug court participant taking this ownership and responsibility for their own recovery. This means developing their own recovery management plan, not only in addition to their initial treatment plan, but they have to develop their own recovery management plan. From this next slide, we can see that a long-term recovery management plan is important because drug dependence is a chronic disease and people are at risk of relapse for a fairly long period of time after treatment and after drug court. These results happen to be from a large sample of clients in publicly funded programs in a large metropolitan area in the Midwest. The slide shows that almost two-thirds of the relapse occurs within 12 months after treatment. After 1 to 3 years of abstinence, over one-third of those will relapse. Yet, after the fourth year of abstinence, only 14% relapse. This is why an acute care model doesn't work well for our high-risk, high-need population. And we have to move to a chronic or continuing care model to overcome drug dependence for the long term.
Thank you, Jeff. Jim, can you describe any examples of continuing care that have been found through research to be effective?
Yes, there have been a number of different models that have been shown to be effective in carefully done research studies. These include home visits by a nurse, which provided over a 12-month period to alcohol-dependent patients, couples behavioral marital therapy, a form of couples counseling that was provided to, again, alcohol-dependent patients and their spouses over a 12-month period, There have been a number of studies that have shown that extended telephone contacts of 12 months or more produce better outcomes. There is information from the adolescent treatment world that very strong assertive attempts to link adolescents to various community services following residential care leads to better outcomes. There's an intervention called recovery management checkups, which I'm going to talk about in a minute or two, so I won't go into that now. And finally, there's good evidence that intensive case management provided to either men or to women can produce better long-term outcomes as well. Now, in addition to these formal continuing care treatment services, there are a number of other sources of recovery support that have evidence that they work. And these include mutual and self-help programs such as AA and NA, peer recovery organizations. These services are more available in some states than others. Housing and vocational services that help to get substance abusers into stable housing and helping them to get back into the employment market. There's been more recent information that strongly suggests that that interventions provided 24/7 via smartphones and text messaging, these are automated services, can also help improve outcomes. And finally, we have good evidence that drug court alumni groups help to improve outcomes.
Thank you, Jim. That's a great list for us to start with. I'd like to just stop a moment and ask a few questions to our practitioner panelists. Joe Schwartz, one of our themes in this webinar is the need to build in recovery support services right from the start of the drug court program initiation for the participant. What suggestions can you offer to other programs regarding developing resources to provide the recovery support Jim has just referenced? For example, developing vocational services, one of the critical needs for most drug court participants.
It's very important that the participants have jobs after they complete drug court to give them a sense of purpose. I would suggest right from the beginning, drug courts partner with your local community college to develop what we call in Rochester a court-to-college program. Make sure your community college is a partner in your program. They will provide you with GED programs and college programs for your participants. These will continue after drug court. Also, partner with your local Department of Labor. They have a wealth of vocational programs and a long possibility of jobs. Take advantage of these programs and make them, more importantly, part of your team to help you to develop more educational programs and more vocational programs.
What about housing? Any suggestions in terms of getting access to housing, which is a key need for most drug court participants, clean and sober housing?
Clean and sober housing is very important, particularly throughout, but in the beginning stages. So a drug court team's responsibility is to get to know what transitional living programs you have in your area. Again, partner with them. Find out what safe recovery houses are in your area and find out what halfway houses. Make them a part of your drug court team. And then again, slowly develop programs that will suit the drug court and the acute care stages and more particularly afterwards.
Thank you, Judge Schwartz. Jeff, how about automated recovery support services such as a smartphone? Have you had any experience with those?
Well, clearly, we've got to start to take advantage of new technology, and the technology is moving very quickly. It's hard to keep up with it. Today, almost everybody has some type of cell phone, so we need to take advantage of this. And the research supports electronic contacts with people in recovery, even when they're automated. This brief helps keep people on the right track. I think this type of recovery management technique is particularly important for people in recovery in rural areas and for women who might have childcare issues and have to be homebound. And also for adolescents who are much more in tune with using newer technologies. These kinds of contacts appear to be very effective both when they're done passively or as an automated reminder, as well as when they're done actively in lieu of face-to-face contact. It's been proven both with the military and in other settings that the outcomes are very good using these kinds of technologies.
Thank you, Jeff. Well, turning again to Jim McKay. Jim, what research has been conducted to show the effectiveness of continuing care interventions for persons suffering from substance addiction?
Sure. Well, a couple of slides before, I gave you a list of a number of different interventions that have shown to be effective. I think it's important to recognize, though, that there are a number of interventions that have not done so well in research studies. So that raises the question of what separates the interventions that seem to work well from those that don't. And there really are two characteristics which do a good job of picking the strong continuing care interventions out. The first is that these tend to be interventions that are provided for 12 months or longer. It doesn't mean that the patients go for the entire 12 months, but that the treatment is available at least for a 12-month period. And the second characteristic is that the interventions which include a more active effort to actually deliver the intervention to the person, wherever that works for the person, rather than simply waiting for the individual to come to the clinic week after week, these interventions, which have a kind of outreach built in, also are much more likely to produce positive effects. Now, it's important, though, at the same time to recognize that, like in most areas of research, there are limitations to what we know about continuing care, and I just wanted to let everyone know what some of those limitations are. First, the vast majority of the continuing care research that has been done has been conducted with participants who are not criminal justice populations. Even more specifically to the webinar today, there's been very little research that's been done with drug court participants specifically. So that raises some questions as to how well all this research that's been done on non-criminal justice populations actually translates to the drug court population. So we need to do more work there. A second important limitation is that the majority of the continuing care research that's been done has been done with patients who had graduated from residential or inpatient programs. Now, at this point, 80 to 90% of the treatment that's provided is provided in an outpatient setting. So, again, there are some questions as to whether this research literature completely translates to treatment as it's currently practiced. And finally, like which is the case in almost all research, it tends to exclude the most severe patients who have multiple problems. And so we can't entirely be sure that the findings of the studies will apply to these most severe patients. Now, I wanted to go in depth and talk about two continuing care interventions, which I think address some of the limitations that I was just talking about in the continuing care literature. And the first is adaptive telephone continuing care. The second is recovery management checkups. And I should say that my group here at Penn is the one that's been doing the research on the telephone continuing care intervention. This intervention consists of a series of structured sessions that are delivered over the phone that are about 15 to 30 minutes long. These sessions include what have been found to be the common ingredients of effective treatment. This includes the monitoring of symptoms and progress on a regular basis, the identification of specific problems and barriers to recovery and as those change over time, an emphasis in the sessions on concrete planning and problem solving, and rehearsal of coping strategies that can be used to address the problems and barriers. And finally, the treatment seeks to activate the patient. Because it was pointed out earlier, ultimately the patient really has to take charge of his or her recovery. So we try to do that as much as we can in this intervention. Now, it's typically provided weekly at first, titrated down to twice a month, and then finally to monthly as the patient progresses. I'm going to tell you about two research studies that were done. Briefly, the first study was with 359 patients who were either alcohol or cocaine dependent, with 50% of them dependent on both. And they had all completed a 4-week intensive outpatient program for their substance abuse problem. They were then randomly assigned to 3 different treatment conditions. One was a telephone continuing care intervention. The second was 12-step oriented group counseling, which was really treatment as usual in the program. And the third was an individual cognitive behavioral therapy treatment. And the outcomes for the study indicated that the telephone condition produced better outcomes than either of these other two comparison treatments, and I'll give you more details in just a minute about that. The second study was with 252 alcohol-dependent patients. They were all participating in intensive outpatient programs, which were a little bit longer than the program in the first study. And in this study, the patients were randomly assigned to either get the telephone continuing care intervention over an 18-month period in addition to the intensive outpatient program, or to just get the intensive outpatient program treatment as usual with whatever clinic-based continuing care was provided to patients. So this was a study in which we added the telephone on top of the standard care. Now, in the first study, the main outcomes showed that patients who were randomly assigned to get the telephone continuing care had abstinence rates that were about 12 percentage points higher than standard group counseling in any given 3-month period of what was a 24-month follow-up. In addition, the patients who were cocaine dependent had lower rates of cocaine-positive urines than those who were in the standard group counseling condition, lower by about 10 to 15 percentage points. Now, the telephone condition also produced somewhat better outcomes than the individualized CBT relapse prevention intervention, but the differences were smaller. I'm going to show you this in a couple of figures here. This first figure plots the total abstinence rate in each quarter, each 3-month period over the 24-month follow-up. And in this graph, higher is better because that refers to the percent that were abstinent within a given 3-month rate. And what you can see from this slide is that the patients in the group with the white line, which was the telephone group, had consistently higher abstinence rates than those in the yellow group, which was the standard group counseling, with the relapse prevention CBT group, the red group, in between. Next slide. Now, in the cocaine-dependent patients, as I mentioned earlier, here we have the results of their cocaine urine toxicology test at each follow-up over the 24-month period. Here, higher scores are worse because they indicate a higher rate of cocaine-positive urines within that particular treatment group. And you can see from this slide that the yellow group, that's the standard group counseling, had the highest rates of cocaine-positive urines, followed by the red group, which is the relapse prevention CBT group. The best rates, the lowest rates of cocaine positive urines were in the telephone condition, which is lower, where they maintained a rate of about 25% positive across the entire 24-month follow-up. Next slide, please. Now, in study 2, we found that the patients who got the telephone continuing care, and again, in addition to their intensive outpatient program, were drinking on significantly fewer days per month than those in treatment as usual, the IOP only, especially toward the end of the 18-month follow-up period. In addition, patients who got the randomly assigned to the telephone continuing care calls had a higher abstinence rate in any given 3-month period, similar to the prior study. And that was about 20 percentage points higher than those who just got IOP only, the treatment as usual group, without any additional telephone continuing care. Now, in this study, we also had a brief version of the telephone continuing care that provided monitoring only at each call without any kind of counseling. So it was a very brief call just to get the status of the patient, give them feedback without any kind of counseling. Now, that intervention did a little bit better than standard care, but not as good as the telephone monitoring and counseling. It included the counseling, too. So we could have the next slide. Here you can see a graph of percent days on which alcohol was used in each three-month segment of the follow-up. Here, again, higher is worse, meaning more days of use. And you can see here that the line, the red line, is treatment as usual. That gets really improves a lot while patients are in the intensive outpatient program, but then starts to get worse over time. The black line with the yellow dots is the telephone monitoring and counseling. You can see that had the best outcome. Really very little drinking out in the 13 to 18 month period here, whereas those who got the monitoring only calls, the green line, didn't do as well as the group that got the counseling as well. And these were highly statistically significant findings. Now, the other outcome was the percent that were abstinent within a given three-month period. And here you can see once again that the rates, I'm sorry, let me flip it around. This is the percent with any alcohol use. So this is the percent that are not abstinent in a given three-month period. And you can see that the highest rates of alcohol use were in the standard IOP, treatment as usual, with the monitoring only doing a little bit better, but the telephone monitoring and counseling, again, doing the best, particularly as you got further out into the follow-up. Now, the other intervention I wanted to tell you about is called recovery management checkups. These were developed by Mike Dennis, Chris Scott, and colleagues. They've done several studies with this. This is a somewhat different approach. The idea here is you get people back in for a checkup every 3 months, and you determine whether they've been using alcohol or drugs over that prior 3 months, as indicated by things like using alcohol and drugs on it 2 or more weeks of that 90-day period, being drunk or high all day on any days during that period, not meeting responsibilities due to alcohol and drug use, and so forth. So if the person has any of these things, then they're deemed as being in need of treatment. So rather than an ongoing continuing care, this is a checkup to determine if the person needs to get back into treatment. Can we have the next slide, please? If the person is positive on any of those factors, they're transferred to an individual who has training in motivational interviewing and knowledge of resources and treatment programs in the community. And this person provides personalized feedback in terms of how bad the person's substance use has gotten. This person explores the possibility of returning to treatment and looks at and addresses any barriers that the person might bring up around, gee, it's not a good time, or I can't do it now. This person will schedule an intake assessment for the patient and will do things like provide reminder cards, transportation, and even an escort to get the person back over to the treatment program. There have been two studies I'll tell you about with this intervention. In both studies, patients were randomly assigned to come in every 3 months and get a checkup, but half the patients got the recovery care management. The other half just got the checkup without any kind of intervention at all. In the first study, with almost 450 patients with alcohol and drug use disorders, they were randomized to either, again, to get the checkup or just to get to be followed up every 3 months. And these checkups with the referral to treatment were provided for 24 months. In the second study, very similar. The main difference was the intervention was provided over 48 months, so for twice as long as in the prior study. Now, the results of the first study indicated that, number one, the intervention, the recovery management checkup, got people back into treatment faster, almost twice as fast. They ended up with more days of treatment, which, again, the idea is for people who aren't doing well, you want to get them back into treatment. So this increased the number of days of treatment by about 50%, and it reduced the percentage of patients who needed treatment by the end of the follow-up. So it was successful in improving their substance use outcomes to the point where fewer of them were still in need of treatment at the end of that follow-up. In the second study, Once again, they were the research intervention was successful at getting people back into treatment. Fully 70% got back into treatment versus only 51% the people who were in treatment as usual. And the people who got the recovery managed checkup had fewer days of use and conversely more days of total abstinence over that full four-year period, significantly higher, again, a very significant difference favoring the recovery management checkup over treatment as usual.
Thank you, Jim. These are very interesting findings that I'd like to explore a little bit further with our practitioner panelists. Jeff, you're working with a number of drug courts in rural areas. What uses would the adaptive telephone continuing care approach have for programs you are working with?
Well, clearly, Jim's data is extremely important to us, and we have to pay attention to it. Telephone follow-up can be extremely important recovery management tool for drug courts, especially after graduation. In rural areas and with populations that have a problem with making face-to-face appointments, it's even more important. There are other situations where this type of contact works as well. We have participants, for example, that work in the Bakken oil fields out in eastern Montana, where they don't get into treatment as often, and for long periods of time are out in the oil well fields. And this kind of contact, telephone contact, is very important, you know, for a population like that. So I guess, you know, Jim's data is quite convincing, both for telephone follow-up as well as a recovery management technique. And I think we've got to start really looking at these kinds of follow-up recovery management tools.
How would you incorporate this approach into the operations of these drug court programs, particularly those in the rural areas or with persons that live in rural areas?
Well, it always comes down to a matter of priorities of how you're going to spend your time. And I think if we understand how important this contact is to sustain recovery, then we have to find the time and the resources to do it. A telephone follow-up can occur by a drug court coordinator, by treatment staff, by trained clerical staff, or by a peer mentor who's been through the drug court, received appropriate training, and has established a really good, stable recovery. So I think we just have to be creative about how we can find the resources to do this kind of follow-up, because it's critically important.
What about the recovery management checkups?
Well, the recovery management checkups, as Jim pointed out, are effective, and we've realized that in Montana. And we actually have two drug courts that are using recovery management checkups and a third that's going to start shortly. At this point, the protocol is being administered by the drug court coordinator, and they're using the short version of the GAIN, which was also developed by Chestnut Health Systems. Clearly, the recovery management checkup process is effective with the recovering population, but there has been no real evaluation, as Jim pointed out, with the drug court participant population, although I don't know why the results would be any different with this population.
Just one final question on this. Looking back to your role as drug court coordinator for the St. Louis, Missouri Drug Court, are there any differences in the approach you might have considered in St. Louis for introducing these two strategies for continuing care compared with how you might move forward in the less urban and more rural areas of Montana where you're currently working?
Well, again, of course, the numbers are a lot different. In the St. Louis Drug Court, we had as many clients on a daily basis in our drug court as almost as many as we have in the state of Montana at any point in time. So I think the resources needed to follow up with participants in urban courts just takes more person power to do it. I think the concept of telephone follow-up and recovery management checkups will work in either setting. And I think, Jim's data points that out, although I don't know that there's been any rural evaluation of rural programming in this area. Most of it's been done in urban settings. I must again add that we've got to look at models and evaluation of programming for recovery management techniques in rural areas, because we can't just assume that what's going to work in an urban area is going to work in, you know, in rural Montana or Missouri or wherever. So the models have to be developed and the research has to be done, but I think both telephone follow-up and recovery management checkups will work in both areas.
Thank you, Jeff. I'd like to now turn to Judge Schwartz, and of course, if you have any comments on the telephone or the recovery management checkups, you know, please add them. But specifically, in addition to the active Rochester Drug Court alumni group that has been operating for many years, what other recovery support strategies has Rochester been exploring or using?
Subject to one's freedom of religion, we direct drug court participants right from the beginning to attend NA or AA meetings. We monitor their attendance, although it's not a foolproof system. Hopefully, this eventually leads to their going to these meetings on their own. We teach them that addiction is a lifelong disease, and they have to develop coping skills for the rest of their lives, and NA and AA is just one method. In New York also, the State Office of Alcohol and Substance Abuse is developing Recovery Coach Program. These hopefully will be drug court graduates who go to specialized training in the treatment agencies and then become certified by the state of New York to become recovery coaches. Also, if you operate a veterans court, your local American Legions in Vietnam War Veterans Post are a valuable source of veterans mentors for the participants in your veterans court.
Thank you. We're going to come back to the veterans court mentors in a few minutes, but that's a very important point that you make. Both George Schwartz and Jeff Kushner, you've been both strong proponents of participants being involved in self-help groups. And I know Judge Schwartz has just mentioned requiring participants to join and participate in AA and NA. What advice would you offer other programs in terms of promoting participants' involvement in self-help groups? I'll start first with Judge Schwartz. Is there anything you want to add, and then go to Jeff?
The advice that I give is what I stated. We mandate, subject to their freedom of religion, of course, that they go to these meetings and that they do a little report, not identifying who was there, what was taught, and what they like and don't like about them. And then we encourage them to go to the ones they like and not go to the ones they dislike. Hopefully this will be a tool that they can use for the rest of your life, and it's a tool that's readily available to them and at no cost.
And I just want to add that I know many programs have sought out just self-help groups that may not have an AA/NA affiliation but are still self-help focused, so that they don't have any religious connotations to them.
We use them when people object to them because of the freedom of religion. So we do use those programs.
Yes, thank you. Jeff, did you want to add anything?
Well, I would only add, I guess, that there are many paths to recovery, and some people do it without treatment. Some people do it without participating in self-help programs. But many, many people in recovery have extensive histories of participating in self-help groups. Scott and Dennis did a research project, and just to quote their results, they said, among patients who started the year in recovery, the major predictor of whether they maintained abstinence was not treatment, but their level of self-help participation. So I agree with Judge Schwartz completely. Everyone should be exposed to and be required to participate in self-help groups. And as both of you have stated, a secular alternative should be available if someone objects to the spiritual or religious aspects. And by the way, there are plenty of these secular options available over the internet that are effective as well. So drug courts, treatment programs should prepare drug court participants in the initial phase of drug court for what they're going to experience when they go to a self-help meeting. They should be told to find a self-help group that they like, that meets their needs, and where they can eventually find a sponsor, as I think Judge Schwartz mentioned as well.
Thank you both. Well, just turning back to Jim McKay. Jim, has the research found that certain individuals benefit more or benefit less from continuing care services than others?
Yes, there has been research on this, and a couple of different findings seem to emerge at least fairly consistently across studies. And one is that people who have greater pretreatment substance use severity and also the kind of associated problems that go with it tend to benefit to a greater degree from continuing care. And also people who start treatment but make relatively poor progress during the initial phase. And this is particularly true of people who are getting their initial phase of treatment in an intensive outpatient program. So patients who continue to drink or use drugs and don't get involved in AA and other things like this, they tend to benefit to a greater extent from continuing care because, you know, they just are not really getting into a stable recovery. So to give you some more specific examples of this, the kind of pretreatment factors, characteristics of the patients before they enter treatment that predicts who's going to benefit to a greater degree from continuing care include greater alcohol use severity, an earlier onset of substance use problems, most specifically people who are beginning to use before the age of 15, more prior treatments for substance use disorders, history that includes more criminal activity and violent behavior, and those who have more severe marital problems, again, are all going to benefit to a greater extent from continuing care. There's also some evidence from a number of studies that women may benefit to a greater degree than men do from extended continuing care. Now, the other factor that I talked about, the effects of their initial progress in treatment. Now, here we have some studies that have shown that patients who continue to use alcohol or drugs at all during the first few weeks that they're in an intensive outpatient program will benefit a great deal from the provision of extended continuing care, whereas those who get abstinent right away from the start and stay abstinent really don't benefit from the addition of this extended continuing care because they do quite well without it. Also, we have found that patients who, by the time they've been in treatment for about a month, patients who are not committed to abstinence at that point, and patients who have poor social support for recovery, meaning they're still hanging around with some people who are supporting or even advocating their continued substance use. If they're still hanging around with people like that after a month of intensive outpatient treatment, they will benefit from the extended continuing care model more than patients who have a nice source of social support.
Thank you, Jim. And these are very, very important points that you made, because in addition to describing the types of individuals who particularly benefit from aftercare and recovery support services, you have just described the high-risk, high-need individual whom drug courts are designed to target. You've also reinforced the importance of providing special support and services for participants who do not appear to be progressing well in the early stages of the drug court program, and why it is so important to try to retain them rather than terminate them, which unfortunately we see some programs doing. Judge Schwartz and Jeff Kushner, Do you have any additional comments on the research findings Dr. McKay just presented in terms of your experience, in terms of who benefits, seems to benefit from the aftercare services? Let's start with Judge Schwartz.
No question, the more severely addicted benefit from aftercare services. And I agree with you, Carolyn, that the goal of every drug court should not be early termination, but success. Failure should not be an option, and then people should be terminated as the last measure. No matter how severe the addiction, you must try to find out what works with that particular individual. It has to be a subjective approach. One size does not fit all, and lifetime recovery is your goal. You got to teach your participants that this is a lifelong addiction problem and that they're going to have to do it, come up with lifelong recovery strategies, and they got to be part of your program. Education, vocational opportunities, jobs.
Thank you. Those are really key points. Jeff, did you have anything to add?
Well, I agree with everything you've said, Carolyn, and the judge, and Dr. McKay as well. I guess my best advice, having been in this field now for, I don't know, over 15 years, is we have to learn to be patient, especially during the initial phases of drug court. Getting over an addiction is very difficult to do, and we require a lot of our participants when they initially enter drug court. It just could be that for some of our participants, we ask too much of them initially. Maybe we need to back off a little bit and lessen our requirements for some who are severely drug dependent and, you know, and have this extensive brain disease. We need to allow some of them to go a little slower and to repair the damage that's been done. Secondly, I think it's very important to identify the good things that our participants are doing. I have found over the years that it's very easy for drug court team members to find fault with how drug court participants are doing and to focus extensively on the negative. It takes more time and effort, I think, to also document the good things that are being done and to be encouraging as a result of these achievements, especially if someone continues to use alcohol and other drugs, which, of course, is a symptom of their disease. Some people take longer than others, and we should be patient. We end up terminating people too early when we're not patient with this population.
Thank you. Those are really critical points. And I think often we need to look at the requirements that are imposed on participants when they first come into the program and take into account just the cognitive impairments that they're operating under. And as you say, go slower where it's needed. Jeff, just turning to our discussion of recovery management plans, what would you consider to be the critical elements of a recovery management plan that a drug court participant should develop?
Well, again, the pathway to recovery for the population that we're dealing with in drug court, the high-risk, high-need people, involves the initial periods when, you know, we're basically directing to a large degree what our participants are doing. And as I mentioned earlier, recovery has to eventually be self-directed. And so we've got to understand that while initially we direct these activities, the drug court team has a responsibility to help the individual move to taking charge and exercising choices and decisions. Improving our cost effectiveness and reducing reoffense rates depends on the drug court participant taking this ownership and engaging in their own recovery. And so developing a recovery management plan before they graduate from drug court is, I think, of critical importance. And the plan has to be done by then. It can't be done like the initial treatment plan is done in drug court by the treatment counselor. It has to be primarily developed by the individual themselves. So what should be in a plan like this? Well, I think we can suggest a framework to our participants that would include strategies, of course, for avoiding alcohol and other drug use, including identification of relapse triggers and how they plan to avoid them, how they're going to manage cravings, if they've got health problems, how they're going to overcome those health problems in the long term. Coping with thinking patterns that lead to relapse, criminal behavior and other high-risk situations. How they're going to avoid risky places and deal with peer pressure to use. Identifying high-risk times and how to deal with these times, certain events, celebrations and holidays, and perhaps the anniversary of when a death occurred and how they're going to deal with that. How they're going to manage relapse and who they're going to turn to for help if they need to. How they'll build a better recovery support system and linkages to recovery support groups, recovery support institutions like recovery homes and recovery schools, recovery ministries, abstinence-based clubs that they might belong to, use of recovery support centers, recovery coaches, mentors, and guides. Other life areas that may need to be addressed in the recovery plan would include legal problems, overcoming educational and vocational deficits, where they're going to go if they need employment help. Will they take advantage of the use of recovery checkups and telephone and internet-based systems of continuing care that we've talked about extensively here today? And finally, maybe what family needs exist and what services and supports does their family need as part of this plan as well. The recovery management plan should be in place at least at the time the drug court participant enters the final phase of drug court, and this plan should be the focal point during that last transitional phase out of drug court. The judge can monitor this plan from the bench. The drug court team can monitor progress of the individual in the staffing, and the treatment provider can focus on this plan as well if the individual is still in treatment.
Thank you. I think that gives us a very good framework to move forward. Judge Schwartz, what suggestions do you have for drug court programs and particularly for drug court judges to get the recovery support process started in the beginning stages of an individual's participation in the drug court program? And are your suggestions any different for mental health courts or veterans courts programs over which you also preside?
The first thing, any drug court, mental health court, DWI court, or veterans court should do is assess what recovery resources are available in your area. You'd be surprised at what is available in your community and what is available for free. For example, there's GED programs. If you go to your local community colleges, you can set up a court-to-college program. We have the Department of Labor. They have vocational skill programs. They have job placement programs. The community college in your area and the Department of Labor in your area should be a part of your team. Also, look what transitional housing is available. What halfway housing placements do you have? And what supportive living programs are in your area? Again, make them a part of your team. Make them feel that they're part of the solution. Don't just use them. Make them work with you. Use the 12-step programs right from the beginning. They are so important. Again, it's a resource that's available for the person's life. Also, develop information packages for family members to tell them what the disease of addiction is, what your treatment program is going to consist of, and encourage family members to be part of your program. Develop mentor programs within your court. This is particularly easy if you run a veterans court. Check with your local American Legion post, your Vietnam Veterans of America organization. Ask them to provide volunteer mentors, and you will find you will have more volunteers than you need. Trade them to be mentors, have them pick a leader, and also have that leader part of your membership team. Work with your office of state, your state office of alcohol and substance abuse, to learn more about recovery coaching programs. If there's one available in your state and in your area, make sure that is also part of your formal drug treatment court program. Create an alumni association within your court. Give them projects to do. For example, drug court alumni are a big part of the mandated new participant orientation program that each person must attend. They also run the graduation ceremonies. Give them other projects to do, like safe, healthy, dry events that they can participate in, ball games, baseball games, football games. Give them projects, put them to work. Again, have them elect a leader and make that leader part of your team. If all your team members put your heads together, we'll think of things for them to do, and you have to have things for them to do. Have your alumni group arrange for drug-free social events. Most importantly, make feel they know their efforts are helpful on behalf of the drug court. Make sure your treatment leaders, your treatment agencies that service your drug court, take advantage of recovery coaches. Make sure your treatment providers within treatment itself develop a recovery management plan and the initials in phase two of the treatment. Initiate checkups through your mentor courts and through your recovery coaches. Design your own mentor courts so that they last, your mentor program, excuse me, so that they last long after drug court.
Judge Schwartz, I know that Rochester has had one of the most effective and long-standing alumni groups. How has the alumni group been sustained over the years? Who keeps up the momentum?
The drug court judge and the staff keep up the momentum for the alumni groups. We give them projects for them to do. For example, as I said, they do the orientation program. They run the graduation ceremony. We make them feel that they're a part of the participants' recovery in the program. And also, as I said before, and I think these are very important, it seems simple, have them elect a leader, a spokesperson, what have you, and have that spokesperson attend your monthly drug court team meetings. By making these people feel important, they will keep the enthusiasm going.
Well, thank you. I know that many programs have looked to the guidance that you and Sherry Lentz had provided early on. You also preside over the Rochester Veterans Courts. Of the various approaches for providing recovery support that have been discussed, which do you feel would be most useful for the Veterans Court and which least useful? And I know you mentioned mentors. Are there any other caveats that you could offer on this?
Well yes. The crown jewel of Veterans Court, what makes them stand out, I think, amongst the other treatment court, is your Veterans Mentors Program. And we obtain those veterans, a lot of them from the American Legion, a lot of them from the Vietnam Veterans Post. Now, all of us who grew up in the 60s know that when the Vietnam veterans returned back, they were not felt welcome. They were not considered heroes. They were not looked upon as shining examples of American citizens. They know how it feels to be ignored, and they are bound and determined to make sure this generation of returning soldiers are not neglected like they were, and they will do everything possible to help them return to a normal life. They understand drug addiction, alcoholism. Most importantly, they understand traumatic brain injuries and depression. They've been through it. they can talk to the participants in Veterans Court one-on-one, ways that you and I cannot do. The participants will open up to the mentors more so when they'll open up to us until they start trusting us. That's a very, very, and I can't emphasize enough, very valuable resource to use in your Veterans Court. Fortunately, because most of your veterans have a high school diploma, you don't have to set up GED programs for this particular group. Take advantage of, again, what is available in your community, and these are your veterans organizations who will do anything to help a fellow soldier.
Thank you. Are there any of the recovery support tools that we've talked about today that you find particularly helpful or less helpful for the mental health court participants?
Well, the mental health participants, I think both Jeff and you said it very well. You got to take it very, very slow. You have to understand mental health diseases. You have to understand cognitive impairment. And you, as the drug court judge and the drug court team, must understand that they cannot make unreachable goals. And by placing unreachable goals in front of them, you only frustrate them more and you're going to have a greater failure rate. Again, look for success, not failure. The goal is to help them, not to determine who's not going to take the help right away and kick them out.
Very, very important advice. Jeff, do you have anything that you can add?
Well, I would like to, I guess, mention peer mentors, because as the judge said, we use them extensively in veterans courts, and it's easier in a veterans court because we have those individuals, as the judge indicated, that feel responsible for helping their other patriots when they come back to transition. But I also think we could use them a lot more in our other categories of drug courts. And there is a center for that's called Bringing Recovery Supports to Scale Technical Assistance Strategy. It's funded by SAMHSA. And this is a center that offers free technical assistance to anyone who's interested in setting up a peer mentoring or peer coach program, and help to find the finances for it. And so if anybody really is interested in developing peer mentors or peer coaches for their drug court, this is a place to start. If you don't know, there are 18 states now that have certified peer recovery support specialists working in their drug dependency treatment field. And most of the states have training programs already set up of these 18 states, and that's part of the certification process. So there are various ways to fund them. Medicaid funds some of peer recovery programming, the Substance Abuse Prevention and Treatment Block Grant. Some states use beer, wine, and liquor tax revenues, and there are other ways as well. So I hope that our drug courts will look at potential peer mentoring programs, not just in our veterans courts, but in our other drug courts as well.
Thank you, Jeff. And I know that a number of programs have developed training programs for their mentor programs, because it's not simply bringing a mentor in to work in the program, but there needs to be a clear protocol developed in terms of the role of the mentors and how they can be most effective and how they can be determined to be selected. We've talked a lot about the different recovery support strategies, so I just wanted to ask Jeff and then Judge Schwartz if there were anything else they wanted to add in terms of strategies they feel that are particularly appropriate. Let's start with Jeff for rural areas and might be less effective for rural areas, and then Judge Schwartz, strategies that are particularly effective for perhaps an urban area. So, Jeff?
Yeah, I guess if I was interested in developing additional recovery management tools for my drug court participants, one of the first places I would start, and in fact I have started, is to contact my single state agency director for alcohol and drug abuse prevention and treatment in the state. Their goals are usually very consistent with the drug court goals as far as recidivism to drug use and reoffense rates, and they understand how important treatment is to our drug courts, and they also understand how important our drug courts are to their treatment programs, because we are much more successful with the clients that are in their treatment programs than the treatment as usual groups. Also, they're very knowledgeable in most cases about recovery initiatives and where the funding can come from to help drug courts implement recovery-oriented systems of care. There's also another federal agency that SAMHSA funds called Faces and Voices of Recovery. I mentioned the Center for Bringing Recovery Supports to Scale. Both of these centers have free technical assistance available, and I would encourage people to use them. I've used them, and they've been very helpful with my state drug court conference and other needs. We use them to help in a presentation at the National Association of Drug Court Professionals at National Harbor this last July. So those are a couple of resources that I would really encourage people to take advantage of. I think, again, SAMHSA and BJA are also recognizing the importance of recovery support and providing funding through their categorical grant programs for efforts that we've discussed today. It clearly is a movement that's becoming more and more important, and people are realizing that in order to move, I think, to the next level of success for drug courts, we've got to focus on recovery management programming.
And I want to stress that BJA can make available resources through their grant program for recovery support functions, and programs are encouraged to look at, into the possibility of accessing these funds. Judge Schwartz, is there anything that you would add in terms of recovery support services that might be particularly important for a rural area, for an urban area?
Well, the best advice I can give you is how I started off my first slide. You got to access what recovery resources are available in your area, and whether they're free, what's the cost of them, where you're going to get the money to pay for them. The judge and his staff should get out of the courthouse and go to these recovery resources and meet with them. Tell them what you are trying to do, ask for their help, and make them part of your team. By making them part of your team, together, you'll come up with solutions that work in your particular area and that your particular program can afford.
Thank you. These are very important points, and as you know, a separate project that we're working on through the BJA Drug Court Technical Assistance Project is a judicial leadership initiative that I know you're participating in, and that is one of the important messages about the judge getting out of the courtroom, out of the courthouse, and trying to bring in all the other participating agencies that need to be a part of this. Well, recognizing that time is short, are there any closing comments that any of the panelists would like to make to reinforce the importance of aftercare support for the treatment of substance addiction, and particularly for drug court program participants? And Jim, I don't want to put you on the spot, but if there's anything you want to add, you stimulated so much discussion with your earlier presentations.
I think the only thing I'd like to add at this point is I think it would be terrific to see more of these extended recovery supports added on to drug courts so that patients will have some additional supports available to them after they've completed the drug court. Because even though drug courts are not short, I think a lot of the participants who are involved have many, many issues and are going to be at risk for relapse after they leave. So to have drug courts thinking more about providing an extended support system on the back end, I think would really be a terrific change.
Thank you, Jim. And Jeff or Judge Schwartz, do you have anything else? I know you pretty much reinforce the point.
I don't have anything to add except that you must realize recovery services after drug court are essential to long-term recovery, and it's essential that the judge get out of the courthouse and go ask for help and make people who are going to help you partners in your program.
Thank you. Jeff, anything you wanted to add?
No, nothing to add. I just want to thank you, Carolyn, for scheduling this webinar. I think it can be very important and hopefully, move drug courts in the right direction to establishing recovery-oriented systems of care for their clients. Thanks.
And we encourage any persons who view this webinar to follow up with any of the panelists on any of the comments that they make. We will have a transcript of the questions and answers for people to be able to refer to. I would like to just show the next two slides are the references that have been cited during the course of these discussions. And we'll also have a separate resource listing. We wish to thank the presenters for participating in this webinar and to the Bureau of Justice Assistance and the National Institute of Justice for providing the support for this session, and to Tim Jeffries, Tracy Lee Williams, and Linda Truitt for their ongoing guidance for its development. Thank you.
Thank you. Please stand by.